I don't really have a favorite composer, but if I did, Carl Ruggles would certainly be in my top five. I've actually already looked at his music on this channel. If you haven't seen it already, I've produced a video on his piano piece Evocations No. 4, and I'm returning to him here. So this is maybe something that I should explain, because Ruggles is not a particularly famous composer. Certainly outside of the United States, he's not played all that often at all. You very rarely see his name on concert programs in Europe. And the other remarkable fact about him is that despite the fact that he lived to be 95 years old, he produced only 8 pieces during his lifetime. So that's barely an hour's worth of music. Not very much. So certainly in terms of the number of works he composed, you can't really count him as a major figure. And the fact is that even today, most concertgoers have probably never even heard of Carl Ruggles. Nevertheless, I think this is an extremely unfortunate omission, and I think that his music should be much better known than it is, and there's a few reasons for that. So first of all, most pressingly, his music has a lot to tell us today in 2020. I think there is something about his music, with its abundance of apparent total contradictions within its language, that is a very rich source of inspiration. So we're going to be talking about what a composer might learn from Carl Ruggles' music, but I think that also for the general public, this is just music of extraordinary power and incredible expressivity. Certainly, by far the most famous of his 8 pieces is Sun Treader for orchestras. That's a 16-minute long piece that does crop up fairly often on concert programs. The conductor Michael Tilson Thomas championed that piece for decades and played it countless times and made a beautiful recording of it as well. Tilson Thomas has also produced a CD of the complete music of Carl Ruggles, which I'd certainly recommend to anybody who's interested in this composer. There's also a second CD that was produced a little bit more recently of the Uncovered Ruggles. So these were pieces that were left in a quasi-finished state at the composer's death, but not necessarily assembled together into a finished score. And these were edited together by the pianist John Kirkpatrick. So maybe we should address the question of why Ruggles completed so few pieces despite his longevity. The fact is that in addition to these 8 published pieces, and you could maybe expand that to 10 if you count the arrangements that he also made of those pieces, there's a gigantic mass of material that lays either completely unfinished, semi-complete, or just exists only as a huge collection of individual sketch pages. For example, we know that he labored for well over a decade on an opera project that was very close to completion, but that he simply never published. There are also many extensive pieces that were sketched but never published. So there's a few reasons for this. One of them is his habit of composing pieces in very, very small fragments that he would try out in a myriad of different ways. So this is an approach that composers don't often take, simply because it's so ridiculously time-consuming. Ruggles, unlike many composers of his generation, had absolutely no system for composing. He had no articulated method for how he would go about putting his notes together and forming chords. There's a few basic technical precepts which we will look at in this video, but for the most part there's really no theorizing. And Ruggles himself was somewhat proud, actually, of not really having studied music theory and not being particularly aware of what was going on across the Atlantic at the time that he was writing his pieces. The majority of his pieces were written in the 1920s. So this was contemporaneous with the development of the 12-tone system of Arnold Schoenberg and other developments in Europe. How does a composer work if they don't have any particular system or grammar that determines what notes they can choose and how they put rhythms together and this sort of thing? Well, this is one of the central mysteries of Ruggles, really, because it's actually very rigorous music. He was intensely perfectionistic, and he could not let a piece sit until he'd tried out hundreds of different variants, trying out all sorts of ways that he could put the piece together. So he was very rigorous in many respects. He was actually somewhat suspicious of pieces that would come a little bit too easily. I think he needed to have this process of an extended refinement, extended process of trying different things out and seeing what fits. It was basically a trial and error approach to composition. So you would try a few notes of music, a few bars at the very most, a few chords, try them out 100 times, try them out with slight variations, change a note here and there, and see what works. So a piece like Evocations for piano, this is a 10-minute set of 4 pieces for piano, which he worked on for well over 15 years. And there are over 1,000 pages of sketches for this one piece alone in the Yale Music Library. So you can imagine the gigantic amount of labor that goes into producing these very, very short little pieces. And they do have a kind of extraordinary sheen about them, a kind of incredible perfectionism where every note counts and every note is very carefully weighed and considered and just fits perfectly within its context. So there's a kind of incredible richness and density to a typical Ruggles piece where a lot happens in a very small span of time that causes these pieces, in my estimation, to transcend their very short duration. They seem to contain much more than what you actually get in terms of minutes and seconds. So I mentioned that Ruggles had no system, so I want to place that in a bit of a context, because composers who were dealing with the immediate aftermath of post-romanticism and hyperchromaticism, extended tonality, pandiatonicism, atonality, and all of these new developments that started to emerge in the early decades of the 20th century, had to confront a central problem, which was if you subtract the grammar of functional harmony from your music, in other words, if you no longer have diatonic scales, if you no longer have chords that you can give names to, dominant seventh chords, dominant ninth chords, if you no longer have augmented sixth chords, and so on, what do you do? How do you put your music together? So this was a problem that was confronted by many composers simultaneously in the 1910s and 1920s, and they came up with very different solutions. So there's Bartok and Stravinsky writing folk-inspired music or writing music that uses modes. Debussy also used modes in his compositions. He used the whole tone scale. Schoenberg, of course, developed the dodecaphonic system, the 12-tone system, in 1923 that he then transmitted to Berg and Webern, among many other composers. So there is a kind of a generalized search for something that could, if not replace tonality, then at least serve as a kind of adequate technical armature that would allow composers to write their works without having to torture themselves at every moment about what note they were going to choose next. But Ruggles didn't go that way. So there's a few reasons for that. One of them is he had this commitment to a kind of independence of spirit. He wanted to search for a certain essential freedom in his music. And I think that really where this comes from fundamentally is Wagner. So if you look at Wagner's music, you have these long, complicated chromatic lines in which the themes sort of seem to spill out of each other and expand and move in all kinds of surprising and unexpected directions. But what you do get in Wagner a lot of the time is the primacy of the line, of the horizontal dimension in music. If you look at the way that themes tended to be constructed in the Baroque and classical periods, they tended to be built out of arpeggiations of major or minor triads. That's not the case in Ruggles. There are no arpeggiations of triads in his themes. They're very free, they're very free-ranging. They tend to be rather long. They tend to be built in a wave-like shape also, which is something we're going to address a little bit later. And of course, they're very chromatic. So as a matter of course, if you're going to assume that the primacy, the most important dimension in your music is melody above everything else, then if you want to expand on that with a certain degree of freedom, you're going to get chromaticism, and this is what we have. So in Ruggles, you often have an incredible density of individual melodic lines, each pursuing its own path more or less freely, and that tend to relate to each other in a generalized form of dissonant counterpoint, which is a very specific technical term that we're going to look at a little bit later. So just to summarize about Carl Ruggles, a composer with a small output, all of the pieces are essential. It's intensely expressive music. It's very, very condensed, very concentrated. And there's a sort of central opposition in his music between two totally incompatible qualities. On the one hand, he's very perfectionistic. He's very rigorous in his approach. He works very, very slowly and deliberately. And at the same time, he has this totally romantic, rhapsodic temperament. And you would think those two things would stand in absolute contradiction to each other. And normally they do. But somehow his music manages to reconcile these two totally unreconcilable qualities. So let's have a look at this piece, Lilacs. So Lilacs is a piece written in the mid-1920s, approximately. Again, it had an extended genesis, as did all of Ruggles' pieces, but we can more or less date it to the mid-1920s, and it is the central panel of a three-part work for orchestra called Men and Mountains. The two outer movements of that piece are scored for a large romantic orchestra, and the central movement, Lilacs, is written only for string orchestra. So this is the sort of lyric slow movement. It's almost like the slow movement in a symphony. So this piece, Lilacs, has a number of unusual qualities. So one of them is that, as I mentioned earlier, the music is fundamentally very linear and melodic and horizontal in its basic approach. And you have all of these independent melodic lines that tend to clash against each other, so that there's always some kind of a dissonant relationship between the different lines that are going on simultaneously in the piece. And in many respects, it's a very classically written work. There are no unusual sound effects or coloristic effects in the string writing. There isn't even a single pizzicato in this piece. It's just all normal arco playing. It's contrapuntal music. So there's nothing in the score that, as you first look at it, appears to be particularly unusual in terms of texture. But when you look closer at the music, you do start to see that there's something very strange about it. So it's very hard to determine what it is actually that makes this piece hold together as well as it does, because when you look at it closely, it doesn't actually make a whole lot of sense. The texture keeps changing. Sometimes we have 7 lines going on at the same time, sometimes 4. Sometimes you have totally independent lines, sometimes they form octaves, sometimes you have an imitative texture, sometimes you have a totally free contrapuntal texture. It keeps changing, and sometimes it changes within a single bar. So there's very little consistency to it. And you would look at it on paper and think, this piece doesn't work. It doesn't make sense. It's written in this weirdly haphazard way. And yet it actually, when you listen to it, it holds together magnificently. And it just, you don't even ask yourself the question. It just has a very powerful effect. So I want to look at the ways in which this piece could simultaneously be so free and yet so rigorous at the same time.
Hi everyone, this is a short message from your host. I'm proud to share what I hope you will agree are high-quality conversations with performers and composers doing compelling work for free. I'd like to keep it that way for a long time to come. But this show does take time and resources to produce, and you can help by becoming a patron of the Samuel Andreev podcast and my YouTube channel. It's incredibly easy and simple. For as little as $5 a month, you can help keep the show going in exchange for exclusive downloads, books, CDs, even personalized conversations and lessons. Please visit www.patreon.com/Samuel Andreev for more information, or click the link in the podcast description. Or if you prefer to make a one-time donation, you can do that at www.samuelandreev.com/donate.
So as I've mentioned, there's a rich assortment of internal contradictions in this piece, and it shouldn't work, but it does. And I can't exactly tell you why that is, but I'm going to lay out some of the basic technical precepts that underpin this work. So one of them is the concept of dissonant counterpoint, which I mentioned earlier. So this is a term that you often hear referred to with respect not only to Carl Ruggles, but to other American composers of the sort of ultra-modern generation working in the 1920s. The 1920s in New York particularly, but not only New York, saw an explosion of incredible avant-garde music activity that was very distinct from what was happening overseas. There was a small circle of composers, not just Ruggles, but also Ruth Crawford Seeger, Edgard Varèse also, who wrote almost all of his important works in the 1920s. You have Henry Cowell, Wallingford Rieger, and other composers as well, who single-handedly redefined the possibilities of American music in a very free and very original manner. And you often hear this term, dissonant counterpoint, applied to their work, and it's not always clear exactly what that means from a technical perspective, because these are composers that did very individual and different things. Basically, the term was invented by Charles Seeger, who is an American musicologist and theorist. And at its origin, what it really was an attempt to provide some kind of a pedagogical, theoretical underpinning for writing dissonant music. So music, in other words, that wasn't limiting itself to the possibilities of functional tonality, but that was using a lot of dissonant relationships. So Charles Seeger's idea was that you could take the rules of standard counterpoint and more or less stand them on their head. So in other words, instead of having a situation in which consonance is normative and dissonance is something, is like a local disturbance in the texture that has to be resolved, in dissonant counterpoint, those relationships are totally reversed. So in other words, dissonant vertical relationships are the norm, and consonances are things that happen only periodically and must be resolved by a dissonance. So that was a kind of a simple theoretical framework for how you could deal with these new sonorities in a consistent way. And of course, he came up with categories of what constitutes a perfect dissonance, an imperfect dissonance, a perfect consonance, an imperfect consonance, and so on and so forth. And he produced various exercises, almost like species counterpoint in varying numbers of voices with different gradations of difficulty, and produced this whole sort of theoretical textbook about how one might go about writing dissonant counterpoint. So these rules are not really applied rigorously in Ruggles. He wasn't rigorous in that sort of technical or theoretical manner, but nevertheless, something of that idea is present in Ruggles' music, in the sense that somewhat similar to the situation in Hindemith, where you have not only complex dissonant chords, but you also have occasional normal triads happen in his music. The interesting thing about Hindemith is that he felt that, unlike Schoenberg, it should be possible to have both of those things coexist in a single piece. You should be able to have both a triad or a dominant seventh chord and a complicated, very dissonant, very chromatic chord, and somehow travel between those two extremes and have a dynamic interaction between those two types of materials. So you could have a continuum with, on the one hand, very simple diatonic materials, and on the other, very complex chromatic materials. And there's something of that in Ruggles' music as well. So the fact that he used atonal aspects in his language, very chromatic chords, did not preclude the use of tonal elements as well. So occasionally the piece will be going along with its very, very dense, very chromatically saturated texture, and then suddenly you'll have a half-diminished seventh chord, or you'll have an augmented sixth chord, or a diminished triad, or a regular triad, or something like this. It's actually a very difficult thing to do, I would say, to find a convincing way to reconcile those two approaches to writing. The Schoenberg approach, the Webern approach, was simply to legislate them out of the music altogether, to make it extraordinarily difficult for a triad to actually appear in the texture of that music. And there was a few theoretical reasons why they wanted to do that, but they wanted to keep the texture consistent. That's not the case here in Ruggles. So there's a very wide range of chord types that you see in this piece, and a very, very wide range of sonorities. The other fundamental stylistic precept in Ruggles is the idea of phrases that are constructed in waves. Now, I've talked about this also in my video on the evocations pieces for piano. A typical Ruggles melody is always rising and then falling, and then rising and then falling again, and then rising and falling. And the waves will typically gain an amplitude as they go along. So it'll go like this. It'll get a bit wider, and then a bit wider, and then a bit wider, and so on. So this approach to constructing phrases really is quite extraordinary, because it means the music always has this intense feeling of forward momentum. A third technical and aesthetic precept in Ruggles is his relative lack of repetition. So repetition of all kinds. So themes are almost never heard identically twice. Usually when he brings a theme back, it's varied in some manner. And he is also extremely fastidious about pitch repetition. So what that means is, typically in a Ruggles piece, and he gets more and more consistent about this as he goes along, he limits himself to having between 7 and maybe 10 distinct chromatic pitches before he'll repeat any of them. So if you have a C natural that appears in a piece, he's going to wait for another at least 6 or 9 distinct pitches to follow that C natural before he introduces that pitch again. He simply wants the memory of the pitch to have faded by the time that you hear it again in some new context. So that effectively prevents any particular pitch from becoming the center or becoming the tonal focus of a passage. So you have this constant turnover of chromatic pitches, a kind of perpetual chromatic saturation in Ruggles' music, where there's a constant flow of new pitches without any particular stabilizing influence coming from any of them. So another final technical attribute of Ruggles' music, as we mentioned earlier, is the fact that you do have occasional suggestions of tonality. It's not rigorously avoiding any sort of reference to functionality. So that brings us to a few things. So remember, dissonant counterpoint, wave-like construction of phrases, avoidance of any kind of repetition, constant chromatic saturation, and the fact that there is still the possibility to have tonal, functional references in the music. So I'd like to take a few specific examples from the score of Lilacs to illustrate these points. So I just start off by talking about the form of the piece. So Lilacs looks at first glance to be in a two-part sort of A and then a variation of A sort of form. But actually, when you look at it a little bit more closely, you see it's a little bit more close to an ABA form. So you have an opening section, a contrasting middle section that in reality is kind of an extended transition, and then a reprise of A at the end of the piece. But the reprise, again, as is typical of Ruggles, is not an identical reprise. It's condensed, it's varied, it's got transposed elements, so it's really not quite the same. And actually, when you're listening to the piece, you don't really have an impression, at least not an obvious impression, of repetition of any kind. You have the impression, rather, of a continual flow of musical ideas. It also has a climax that appears about two-thirds of the way through with a massive eight-note chord, this incredible buildup of pitches that we're going to look at a little bit later in more detail. So let's start by looking at the opening two chords. I'm going to play them on the piano. And despite the fact that it might look like just a couple of chords, there's actually quite a lot happening here. So the first thing to look at in these two chords is that we actually do have an embryonic melodic idea. It's very simple. It's just a descending major second. But this descending major second is a kind of simple melodic idea that then gets taken up and varied in the other voices of the string orchestra. So let's have a somewhat larger look at the opening of the piece. We'll look at the first few bars, and you can see how this two-note descending motif is repeated again higher and then still higher, so that we have a feeling of an ascending phrase built out of this one motif. Okay, now let's look at these first two chords in the piece. So there's something strange about them. They don't sound conspicuously atonal, but they don't sound particularly tonal either. They're sort of in between. And I think these sorts of chords are very typical of Ruggles in the sense that very often you'll have something that looks like a triad, but with a dissonant note thrown in. So this dissonant note completely changes the character of the chord, and that's the case here. So in these chords, you have a D in the bass against a D-flat in the soprano, and in the second chord, you have a C in the bass and a C-flat in the soprano. Now let's have a look at this melody that's exposed in the first violin. So once again, it's very chromatic, it's wide-ranging, and you see this sort of wave-like shape of the phrase, where it keeps going up and then going down again. So in bar 6, we see a second motif start to appear, and rather than the two-note opening motif, this is a four-note collection. And it appears in various ways. It appears retrograded and transposed and with various inversions, but fundamentally it's the same collection of pitches. So we have the C, E-flat, D-flat, and A. If we look at bar 7 here, it appears again, this time in a completely different shape in the first violins. A, C-sharp, C, and E-flat. The next time it appears in bar 8 is in a slightly different configuration, here with the pitches A, C-sharp, B-natural, and D-sharp. But you're not particularly aware of the music being constructed out of these tiny cells, because again, it has such a feeling of forward momentum and such classical phrasing in many respects as well. Nevertheless, the way the music really works on a kind of microscopic level is that you have this constant reordering and constantly fresh presentations of very, very small musical ideas. Starting in bar 9, we have an imitative texture in which the second violins are playing the same material as what's going on in the first violins, but staggered by two beats. From bars 16 to 19, we have quite a remarkable passage that is one of my favorites, actually, of all of Ruggles, in which you have this pileup of pitches. And this is something that he does actually relatively often, is that in order to create a harmonic texture, he'll take individual notes from a melody and sustain them until they turn into chord tones. And that's exactly what happens here. And this results in this buildup, this gradual buildup of an eight-note chord. So here it is, and this really is the climax of the piece. It's the most complex, the most dissonant chord that you hear in the piece, and it arrives at a key point, and you can also see that the dynamics here are more and more intense, leading up to a crescendo of fortissimo. So in terms of the makeup of this chord, it's very peculiar because you have a kind of a half-diminished chord in the left hand, the bottom four notes, and the top chord is almost an augmented sixth chord, but it's slightly chromatically altered. And you have these two chords going on simultaneously. So both of them have kind of a tonal flavor, but they're being heard simultaneously and they're really clashing against each other. And this is just the most incredible sound, these eight notes in the climax of the piece. Another technical idea that crops up again and again in Ruggles' music, and again, it's hard to tell exactly how consciously this was deployed in his music, but you do often see this principle of voice exchange, in which the top note, the note played by the soprano line and the note played by the bass, will switch places. And they'll occur in opposite relationship to each other in the same phrase. This happens in the very start of the piece, when you have a D in the bass and a D flat in the soprano, and then later on, towards the end of that phrase, those two pitches are switched. A further element in Ruggles' harmonic language is his affection for having minor ninths in the bass, so parallel minor ninths that give his bass lines a tremendously tense and dissonant flavor. So a more conventional composer might have simply had octave doublings in the bass register. He never does that. Curiously, he does use octave doublings, but almost exclusively in the high register, and he almost never uses minor ninth doublings in the high register. Rather than adhering to some dogmatic theoretical position, instead, what he's always doing in his music, and again, the success with which he's able to do this is really quite remarkable, he'll create these very local textures that are immediately disrupted. So you'll have a feeling of order of something that starts to be consistent in his music, and then he'll always find some way to recontextualize it, to change it a little bit, to turn it into something else, and to disrupt it, in other words. So you have this constant chain of things that almost become consistent in the music and then gradually shift into something else. So every element, even the tiniest, most microscopic elements in his music, are always shifting, always being seen in slightly different ways. The music is always moving around, always changing, and there's almost no repetition in it, which just gives it this incredible density, this incredible feeling of compaction. And it's not hard to see why he couldn't write more pieces in this style, or why he couldn't write longer works. Because in order to function in this way, you do have to reconcile these total oppositions between order and chaos, between consistency and inconsistency, between perfectionism and this rhapsodic quality that the music has. And all of these internal contradictions are just sort of clashing against each other, making the music incredibly intense, but also very difficult to sustain. So if you want to see what this incredible high wire act is like, again, go out and listen to the complete Ruggles. It just takes an hour of your time, and it will richly reward your attention. I guarantee it.